I am the best wrestler in the world. I've been the best ever since day one when I walked into this company, and I've been vilified and hated since that day because Paul Heyman saw something in me that nobody else wanted to admit. I've grabbed so many of Vincent K. McMahon's imaginary brass rings that it's finally dawned on me that they're just that. They're completely imaginary. The only thing that's real is me, and the fact that day in and day out, for almost 6 years, I have proved to everybody in the world that I am the best on this microphone, in that ring, even at commentary. Nobody can touch me.
That ever lived, and your wrestling messiah. So just sit back and bask in my glory, because this is episode 99 of CM Jude's Wrestling Reviews, right here on the Absolution Network. And on this episode, the last episode before the Covenant, episode 100, and the brand new era for CM Jude's Wrestling Reviews, we are going to end the audio era with a look at what professional wrestling is. This episode is in particular for newcomers who are wrestling fans, who are just discovering their love of professional wrestling, just want to know what professional wrestling is about. It's for wrestling fans to give to their non-wrestling fans, so that maybe they can learn why they like professional wrestling, and just an overall sort of a general look at the art form of professional wrestling and sports entertainment, its history, and where people can find wrestling. All of that and more on this episode, the final episode of the audio era of CM Jude's Wrestling Reviews. And yes, this is the last audio episode, as I'm going to, with the very next episode, which will be covering Wrestle Kingdom 13, I am going to be switching to video. So, and, you know, in a way, it feels very painful, in a way, because, you know, I've been doing audio for over 10 years. I've been doing podcasts and stuff, and, you know, there's a very melancholy feel, because, honestly, to be truthful with you, I'm nowhere near where I thought I would be, you know, and I think everybody who started doing podcasts thought, you know, I'll be successful, and, you know, people will listen, and I might be able to make a career out of this, but, you know, unless you had a big name and get a lot of followers, you know, really, it's everything is that becomes popular, it just becomes too crowded, and, you know, if you're a middle-of-the-road person, not left behind, but I still do it because I love it, and, you know, I'm now moving over to video, and hopefully, I can improve some things, and things will work out better. So, you know, there's a very melancholy feel in moving on from audio. Or at least audio only. But, you know, like I said, this is going to be a look at sort of what professional wrestling is, what sports entertainment is, what the history and everything. And, of course, the way to start out is, you know, at the beginning. At the beginning. So I guess the first question to anybody, particularly those who do not watch professional wrestling or sports entertainment, as it's called, would ask is, what is professional wrestling? What is sports entertainment? And aren't they the same thing? Well, the answer to that last question is yes and no. They are the same thing, but they are also aren't. They are in the same ballpark. But they're basically two different ways of looking at an art form. So professional wrestling, to answer that first question, is the art of telling a story of combat inside the confines of a supposed athletic competition inside a ring, a squared circle, as you will. Again, the history of this, as we'll discuss in a little bit, the general history of America and around the world is, you know, it has its heyday back in the 1800s, back to the carnival. You know, whether it be to, you know, having a contest for strong men to see who could wrestle the other down and hold them down for a pinning predicament, to wrestling with bears. You know, even the great legendary Bruno Sammartino apparently even wrestled with a bear at one point. But that's where it got its start. And you know, as it grew and as it became what it became in the late 20th century, you know, yes, let me make this distinction. It's not fake. Not fake in the sense of what, how people like to use the word fake. You know, it's like, oh, it's fake, as in because it's scripted and the winners are planned out and it's a performance. And they're right, it is a performance, but it's not fake. Maneuvers really do hurt, especially if you do them wrong. It takes years and years of experience to do this right. And when wrestlers retire, they retire with tons of injuries that they're going to have to deal with for the rest of their life. It's not fake in that sense. It's the maneuvers they do are real in the sense of the athleticism that it takes to do them. But as far as professional wrestling is concerned, it's the story of telling those conflicts in that ring. You know, looking at the very simple story of you have a big guy and a small guy, and it's the story of can the small guy you overcome the big guy's strength and power and general dominant force that people would believe, because people, you know, you just look at the size of them and generally you think that the bigger person is going to squash the smaller person. So can the smaller person use his speed and maneuverability and quickness to outmaneuver the bigger guy and beat him, whether it be through catching him in a surprise pin or maybe a submission move or something where he gets him on the ground and gets that quick 1-2-3. You know, things like pins and submissions and the way decisions are met with the different possible stipulations like countouts, and you know, all these are gimmicks, it's as they're called, or tools to help tell that story and tell the story of the match, of who wins, who loses, and that stuff. So that, in a real small nutshell, is what professional wrestling is. It's the art of telling the story in the ring. Sports entertainment, which is really a phrase only used recently because it's coined by Vince McMahon, is sort of the extra stuff outside of the ring that is professional wrestling that helps tell the story. The flamboyant characters, the promos, you know, the superstar status of the wrestlers, really, that's the sports entertainment aspect of it. Because, again, these are athletes. And again, so for instance, a Kurt Angle is an Olympic gold medalist. That Olympic gold medalist mantra and that amateur wrestling background becomes part of his character, and that's the sports entertainment part that really helped make you believe, that combined with his ability in the ring makes you believe that he is this damn good professional wrestler that can beat anybody he wants to. Look at Rey Mysterio, the goat as it is of Lucha Libre. You know, small descendant of size, but his character of, you know, combined with the things he does in the ring, you know, combines for his character. And that character is what's, and this is what the sports entertainment aspect really does, help sell merchandise, which is one of the main things that professional wrestlers make money off of. You know, mind you, obviously wrestlers get a cut of the gate, you know, because that's why, you know, whoever's at the top of the card has an important feature in professional wrestling, because the job of the main event is to draw the most people in, and you want the best match possible to be your main event to draw the most people in. And primarily you want everything on the card to ultimately bring as many people into the gate or the arena as possible, so you can get as big of a cut as possible, so that, and everybody works to try to help everybody get paid. And one of the things that leads to that is, again, these over-the-top, maybe not as over-the-top as they used to be, but still, for our time period, over-the-top characters. And but at the same time, one evolvement that particularly happened in the 90s is people being able to do characters that are closer to really who they are, or at least, as it said, you know, it's my personality amped up to 11, and then maybe we put, make it a, I twist it this way to be, make it a bad guy, I twist it this way to make it a good guy. But again, and that goes to the sports entertainment aspect to professional wrestling. And they're both two different ways of telling the story of this match in the ring. But at the same, it can also be used at the same time to tell the story of what's going on in the ring. You know, the Young Bucks being the elite, I think, is a perfect example of sports entertainment being used outside the ring within a YouTube series, to set up and lead up to matches. I mean, you look at Hangman Page's story of him murdering Joey Ryan, and that ultimately leading up to his match with Joey Janela, which, after he beat him, then the surprise resurrection of Joey Ryan. Again, all that is really sports entertainment, and it's used in conjunction with the art of professional wrestling to create the wrestling business, which is the act of putting on these stories that make people want to come to arenas or turn on their TVs to watch weekly or monthly, to watch pay-per-views, because, you know, as of this recording, in a couple hours, New Japan Pro Wrestling will be having its Wrestle Kingdom, which is, New Japan is definitely more pro-wrestling elevated in its storytelling, and focuses definitely less on sports entertainment, but nonetheless, it's drawing people in with its matches and their wrestlers' personalities that make people want to watch their matches. So, now that I've explained what professional wrestling is, you know, how did it come to be like this? Well, to explain that, we have to explain the history of wrestling, particularly in America. And like I said, it started in the carnivals and things like that, but let's jump to the 1950s. And with the advent of television, wrestling was one of the things that came along for wrestling promoters with amateurs like the Lou Thesz and the natural, Buddy Rogers, the Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, and the like, who came along, and, again, at that point, wrestling was very local. It was, you know, again, wrestlings were basically territories, mostly to small cities, or sometimes a collection of small cities. You know, for instance, the WWE, which used to be the WWF, which used to be the WWWF, back in its heyday, was the Northeast Corridor. It ran Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. And that was its primary region. And, you know, with its home base basically being Madison Square Garden. You had, and other wrestling organizations had their territories. And mind you, not that these all started during this era, but like, and these are name of like territories that popped up throughout the next 30, 40 years, which is, you know, you had WCC, World Class Championship Wrestling, WCCW in Texas. You had AWA, the American Wrestling Association in Minnesota, whose territory was, you know, Minnesota, Chicago, Illinois, Wisconsin, that whole region, bits of Missouri. Is it Deep South or Big South? I'm blanking on the name, but it's like something South Wrestling, which is like New Orleans. I'm trying to think this off the top of my head, so I apologize for getting some of these names wrong. But like Georgia Championship Wrestling, which is Georgia, Florida Championship Wrestling, which is in Florida, the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, with the Crocketts, which was the Carolinas and Virginia. Hawaii had wrestling in that, where Hawaii was just the territory. You had like Hollywood wrestling and those in on the West Coast. And so wrestling was very much territorial. Something that came along in the 1960s was the creation of the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance, which was this partnership basically between all the territories to where they got together and, for the betterment of the boys, as it said, and it'd be an organization to where whenever territories or promotions had beef with each other, they could then work it out through this system. And also through the system, they created a national champion, the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, who basically went around touring the different territories. So, like, Nature Boy Ric Flair, who probably the most legendary NWA champion, would work at one promotion for a month and then move to another promotion and another promotion as the traveling champion, or and not even like to stay in one promotion a month. Like he would maybe wrestle this week for Deep South Wrestling and then the next week wrestle at Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, next week at World Class Championship Wrestling. And whenever a promotion would have a big event, they could hire and have an NWA World Heavyweight Championship match if it was agreed upon by the collective NWA group. And things like the WWWF was part of the NWA in its early days, and all the promotions really were. Though the WWWF, I think in the late 70s, early 80s, would ultimately move away from the NWA and go out on its own. Not every promotion was part of the NWA, but most. In fact, one could sit there and say that pretty much they had a stranglehold and it on professional wrestling. And we'll get, I was just thinking, like, you know, that's what led ultimately to its demise, as it formed a stranglehold and became almost mafia-like in its absolute control on these smaller wrestling territories. But we'll get to that in a second, because we do have to talk about a couple things. We also saw the rise of megastars who constantly sold out buildings during the 60s and 70s into the early 80s. Like I said, Nature Boy, Buddy Rogers, Lou Thesz. I'm blanking on the gentleman who also ran the AWA. Blanking on his name. It's going to come back to me later, but he was a big... Vern Gagne. Big star. Dusty Rhodes came up during this time. Got his initial start in the mid-70s. In the late 70s, Nature Boy Ric Flair came around, got his start, and really exploded into the early 80s. Was really his big coming up. And of course, with the WWF, you had stars like Pedro Morales, Mil Máscaras, Antonio Inoki, who... Well, we'll get to Antonio Inoki in just a second. But, of course, the biggest one being the living legend, what's considered one of the greatest of all time, Bruno Sammartino. The, pretty much, in a way, the Muhammad Ali of professional wrestling, in a way, who sold out Madison Square Garden more than anybody and was WWF's champion for years. I think, like, the first... Can't remember if the first reign was 8 years or more than 8 years. I know it was at least 8 years, but like just held on to it forever, and no one can beat him. And he sold it out. It because he kept bringing in the Italians and the Polish, because again, you know, the makeup of New York City, that was the big population, and they came out in droves for Bruno. And among other things. But basically, especially with WWF's ability in New York to connect with national broadcasting stations like NBC, again, getting his name out and getting him on national TV were big things as well that helped the WWF grow and make money. And ultimately, it's one of the reasons why they left, because they could go out on their own because of the popularity of Bruno. So he was a major figure. But going into the 80s, Vince McMahon Sr. ultimately sold the WWF to his son, Vince McMahon Jr., who had the bright idea to start taking advantage of this new god-dang-fang technology of cable TV. Now, mind you, while the WWF wasn't the first one to use cable TV, there have been some other promotions like Deep South I know anybody listening to this is gonna get it wrong. I know I'm getting it wrong, but I can't for life remember it what the first were. It's something South Wrestling or Mid South Wrestling, Mid Mouth, Deep South. I'm gonna look it up later. I'm like, god damn, I got that wrong, but I just don't have it in front of me. I don't have the wealth of knowledge like Jim Cornette, who you should definitely listen to on the Jim Cornette podcast. Such as the Cornette Drive-Through and others, who again, check out wealth of knowledge on that podcast. Go check it out. But basically, he moved to put WWF on cable TV with the help of NBC with things like Saturday Night's Main Event, and also had the idea of teaming his wrestlers up with super pop culture superstars of the day. Like for the MTV generations and singers, like Wendy Richter was a wrestler, but oh god, what was her name? There's a singer who was popular in the 80s. Can't remember her name, but also actors like Mr. T, who was there for the very first WrestleMania, teaming with Vince McMahon's newest biggest star at the time, Hulk Hogan, who was a wrestler who was actually over at the AWA and started to gain popularity as Hulk Hogan had turned face, came over to the WWE, and Vince started, just termed the phrase Hulkamania. And there's a long story that, you know, it's too long to get into here about the creation of Hulkamania. But just to get to the point, Hulk Hogan was an instant star in WWF and became their top champion and was basically the stalwart of the company. Just to go back a little, because I mentioned his name, Antonio Inoki. While all this is going on in America, wrestling was also taking off in the late 60s, early 70s in places like Mexico and Japan. In Mexico, it became the... I was about to say zone, but it became the land of the masked wrestler, Lucha Libre. And very simple terms, you know, Rudo and Tecnico, the good guy, bad guy. And in Mexico, wrestlers were legends and superstars and rock stars who not only did they wrestle, but they made their own movies and had their own albums, and people would come out every Saturday night to see them. Legends like Mascaras and Blue Devil, Blue Demon, among others, would be legends in Mexico, and they would build up promotions that are still around today, like CMLL. Into the 90s, though, a new promotion, well, we'll get into the 90s in a second, but CML was the big one there forever, and in Mexico City, and Lucha Libre became part of Mexican pop culture. Over in Japan, Antonio Inoki, who wrestled in WWF, brought over his experience and helped create New Japan Pro Wrestling, which implemented sort of Japan's different wrestling style, known as strong style. Japanese wrestling involved more strikes and kicks and had more of a shoot style. And legendary stars, particularly in the 70s and 80s, were people like Antonio Inoki, Giant Baba, just to name a few. I'm still very weak on my wrestling, so I don't have much older Japanese wrestler names knowledge as much as I wish I did. But, of course, in Japan, they also played a lot of having foreigners like Stan Hansen come over and be bad guys against the, you know, hometown hero of the Japanese. In the 80s, Giant Baba would go away from New Japan and create All Japan Wrestling. And so All Japan Pro Wrestling and New Japan Pro Wrestling were the two major companies in Japan. Now, going back to WWF, in the mid-80s, you had Vince McMahon finding success with his rocking wrestling connection, teaming up with pop culture stars of MTV with all of his new wonderful wrestlers like Hulk Hogan, Roddy Piper, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, Macho Man Randy Savage, the Honky Tonk Man, Ultimate Warrior. Ultimate Warrior is something over in Mexico. But Ultimate Warrior, and so on and so on. And these just became pop culture stars because of being on cable TV with weekly shows such as Saturday Night's Main Event and Primetime Wrestling, along with successful pay-per-view events like WrestleMania. And into the late 80s, they would have things such as the, you know, in other special events, but they more importantly had things like the Royal Rumble that started 1989, I want to say. 1989. Of course, their second big pay-per-view started in 1988 with SummerSlam, which would be like the WrestleMania during the summer, as it took place in August. And so major events like that made WWE happening that people wanted to go see. Meanwhile, back in the NWA, things, were, like I said, were falling apart around this time. Because, again, what started as a good thing became a bad thing as the NWA hard control over all these smaller territories, along with these territories not evolving with the times and getting on cable TV and sustaining on local television, add to the fact that talent was leaving all these promotions and going to WWE, particularly the best talent, because again, they could make more money with the WWE. And again, it's a whole other collection of things, but in general, a lot of these territories started to fall by the wayside. To a point to where the NWA really just slowly crumbled away. And really, there's only was a few territories left, including Mid-Atlantic Wrestling. Well, Ted Turner, in the late 80s, ultimately bought Mid-Atlantic and the NWA, or the remaining promotions that were in the NWA, because if they didn't fold, there were also a lot of promotions that ultimately then decided to leave the NWA. Like the AWA would go out on its own in the 80s. But, so Ted Turner bought it and renamed it World Championship Wrestling. And made the NWA, basically what was the NWA champion, the world champion, the WCW champion, and made it exclusive to WCW. And Ted Turner, at that point, decided that he wanted to, you know, be a competitor to WWF at the time, which would later be WWE. As, at that point, Vince McMahon Jr., now known better as just Vince McMahon, as he is nowadays, was the top game in town, was making tons of money. As we go into the 90s, though, by the early 90s, wrestling's popularity that it had in the late 80s had waned off. And pretty much after 92, from 93 really to 95, though for WWE, or should I say WWF, it really went till 97, wrestling was on a downturn. People weren't as interested as wrestling as it was because, again, wrestling was really aimed towards more kids and the audience had grown up and wrestling just didn't feel like it was changing with the times where it's more adult audience that was watching it. Though WCW was able to start compete, during this time, WWE, I should say, started its weekly TV show, Monday Night Raw, in 1993, which is still going today. And WCW in 1994, towards the end of 94, would start its own TV show as they ultimately hired a young man who had relatively still new to the wrestling business. He had gotten his start in the AWA as a backstage interviewer, that being Eric Bischoff. And he threw his hat to, try to run the company as there was an open call for it, got the job, and went on his path to try to compete with WWE. And part of that idea was to do everything different than what WWE was doing. In other words, WWE was still kid-friendly and aiming towards kids. He made the decision that they needed to be more towards adults. And at the start, there were mixed results. One of the things he did was also buy a lot of older talent that had left the WWE, because WWE had decided to go towards a more younger generation, so they let wrestlers like Hulk Hogan and Macho Man go. WCW picked them up because, again, while they were older and didn't move as quick as they used to, again, they still had that star power that they relied on. Another thing that Eric Bischoff did in the 90s was he started the Cruiserweight division, which were smaller wrestlers from all over the world, from Japan, from America, and from Mexico. Wrestlers like Dean Malenko, Chris Jericho, Chris Benoit, Rey Mysterio, Eddie Guerrero, just to name a few, all who became stars of this division. And pretty much the Cruiserweight division became the de facto reason a lot of wrestling fans watched WCW, because it was considered the best pro wrestling on the planet. And just people still to see all of the amazing maneuvers. But things really came in a head in summer of 1996, when Eric Bischoff was able to pull two of WWE's biggest stars at the time, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, a.k.a. Razor Ramon and Diesel, not to break their contracts, but their contracts happened to be up at the same time, and they made them an offer that Vince couldn't match, and so they jumped to WCW, and to which Eric Bischoff used them along with Hulk Hogan for the famous NWO, which is a storyline that's culminated at Bash at the Beach, where Hulk Hogan ended up helping these two outsiders of Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, and it became this villainous group called the NWO, in which Hulk Hogan shocked the world and became a bad guy. Because for over a decade, he had been this amazing good guy that everybody loved. And it was, I remember watching it as a kid, and it was like the biggest swerve I've ever seen. And for the next 83 weeks, Monday Nitro was the show to watch as it constantly beat WWE in the ratings. And this would be the start of what was known as the Monday Night Wars of wrestling, where Raw and Nitro would compete, and the winning show would constantly see anywhere up to 4 to 5 million viewers a week, making it these shows constantly the most watched programming in America at that time. Like I said, though, for 83 weeks, WCW was kicking WWE's ass as it was still kid-friendly. But starting late 97, Vince McMahon, seeing the writing on the wall, finally decided that it was time for WWE to step its game up and be more edgy, as they had up-and-coming superstars like Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, and Triple H. And thus, the Attitude Era of WWE had started. We had things like D-Generation X and their sophomoric yet crude, crass comedy. Stone Cold Steve Austin kicking ass. The energy of The Rock. And so there was more adult content on Monday Night Raw, and people slowly started to turn. Also during the 90s, there was a third promotion in America that rose up. This was ECW, run by Paul Heyman, who came up at first as photographer, then was a play-by-play guy, and then on WCW, and then a manager in WCW who loved professional wrestling, got a chance to run what was, when he got it at the time, Eastern Championship Wrestling. But he decided to make changes to it, and then 1993, in an infamous night where they were basically the last promotion in the NWA, who through conflicts with WCW decided to take away the NWA championship, and thus the creation of the new big belt that would be the WCW championship was created. But NWA needed a champion, and so with Eastern Championship Wrestling being one of its last promotions, they had this match between Too Cold Scorpio and Shane Douglas. Well, Shane Douglas won, but in an infamous promo, he ends up throwing down the NWA championship, saying, "This is not the championship I wrestled for," and he pulls out the ECW Championship, the extreme, the new era of Extreme Championship Wrestling, as you know, basically a defiance against the NWA that shocked them, and thus ECW was born, and ECW became sort of the wrestling fans' promotion. It was widely known for its hardcore matches, hence the Extreme Championship Wrestling. But it also featured a lot of new styles, like the new, like the, the Japanese strong style and the Mexican Lucha Libre style, and the Texas Catch Can style. Really, for the first time in America in those early days, which would catch the eye of people like Eric Bischoff, who would then pull a lot of these type of wrestlers over to create the Cruiserweight division. But ECW was a great mixture of wonderful technical wrestling ability with these more extreme, hardcore wrestling matches. Good appeal, sex appeal. If you know Kimono Watalea dancing atop the ECW arena, and ECW was this, became this cult following of like, it's the wrestling show the real wrestling fans watch. And just, it was basically the third act. And as the Attitude Era, and this is why I bring it up, what part of what brought the Attitude Era was ECW in 97 partnered with WWE a bit for a couple of Raws to bring ECW wrestling to a larger audience on Monday Night Raw, which gave them eyes, which brought them, those eyes to their first pay-per-view, Barely Legal, but also helped push Raw's ratings up as it was something new than the usual kid stuff. And really what helped spark the Attitude Era. This combined with WCW resting on its laurels too much and just the NWO storyline just dragging on and everything. WCW became complacent. Monday Night Raw was changing things up and being new and fresh, and ultimately WWE took back the lead. And I believe it was in April of 98, after the Raw after WrestleMania, they finally defeated WCW's Monday Nitro in the ratings for the first time after 83 weeks. And the war was hotter than ever, but ultimately WWE would win. And WCW would just continue to fall. And really, once America Online bought Turner Entertainment, and basically in a coup knocked Ted Turner out of control of Turner Entertainment, and mind you, they hated professional wrestling, so they sabotaged WCW, put all types of rules, and ultimately just sold it away in, after basically they made WCW a shell of itself. Ultimately just sold it away to WWE in 2001. At the same time, ECW, due to sabotage from its TV deal with TNN, who stabbed them in the back, along with pay-per-view providers not paying them money, basically they went bankrupt and they sold to WWE as well. And so by 2001, WWE became the de facto promotion in America, and pretty much the largest wrestling promotion in the world. In Mexico in the 90s, a new promotion rose up of AAA wrestling, which is a spinoff of people who used to work at CMLL, and they became sort of the second biggest Mexican wrestling organization in Mexico. And in Japan, there were also a lot of smaller promotions. FMW, Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling, which is sort of like an ECW type of style, came up in Japan. other wrestlers would leave at New Japan and start their own promotions, such as Zero One, Pro Wrestling Noah, which is still around today, and is Pro Wrestling Noah now is considered the second biggest promotion in Japan, among others. But New Japan Pro Wrestling, by the end, New Japan Pro Wrestling was the big one, as I believe all Japan would ultimately fold. And so in Japan, there was a lot of smaller promotions like Zero One and Pro Wrestling Noah. But the big one at that point in time was New Japan. In the 2000s, WWE would run its Ruthless Aggression era, followed by what was coined the PG era, but pretty much continued to solidify its hold on professional wrestling, particularly in America. But there would be other promotions that would pop up. You would have TNA, which was run by Jeff Jarrett, and a lot of former NWA members, who would pretty much do a lot of the same things that made WCW successful. They had a lot of stars that didn't move on. When WCW was sold, there were some wrestlers who ultimately didn't go to WWE. And they ultimately went to TNA. When TNA was founded in 2003, 2004. And so you had these big stars like Jeff Jarrett, Sting, DDP. DDP would ultimately be there, but stars like Raven and the such. But they also had a lot of younger talent that didn't really fit in WWE. Stars like AJ Styles, Christopher Daniels, Low-Ki, just to name a few, would be stars of TNA's X Division, which is basically their cruiserweight division, except here, basically, it was a division of No Limits, though it mostly featured stars who were smaller in stature. Also forming during this time was Ring of Honor, which featured stars, a lot of stars that also wrestled in TNA, also wrestled in Ring of Honor, but also stars like Samoa Joe, who would eventually go to TNA, but Samoa Joe, Daniel Bryan, CM Punk would all be sort of the early stars of Ring of Honor. And before, of course, ultimately making their way to WWE. And Ring of Honor was definitely more sort of in the New Japan Pro Wrestling style of wrestling. It had things like, before every match, each wrestler had to shake hands as sort of the honor shake, basically. To show that they respected each other. And it became a way for heels to sting with themselves as not shaking hands, to show dishonor and things like that. And Ring of Honor continued to grow, and it pretty much is considered the second biggest promotion now in America these days. As TNA grew, was the second biggest promotion, and they grew, but ultimately made a lot of bad choices, very similar to what brought WCW down ultimately. It was it was a repeat, except the people in charge of it didn't hate wrestling. And starting to grow back up slowly, but it's really a shell of its former self, to the point to where it's just recently announced its move to Pursuit Channel, which I don't think anybody has, but that's a whole different story. But that was pretty 2000s. In today's era, the recently decade starting in 2010, with the move to digital, in 2014, WWE started the WWE Network, which showed, yet again, the WWE trying to be on the cusp of new technology. In the 80s, it was cable TV. But now it's the internet and streaming service, and they've been on the cusp of it. And it's really changed the wrestling world. And it's inspired other promotions like New Japan to do it. And it's allowed this streaming technology has now allowed New Japan to really expand its reach across the ocean to America. And now a lot more people know New Japan Pro Wrestling, which saw its own expansion in the 2000s. In 2006 in particular, it started its main freight event, Wrestle Kingdom, which is still going on and is only a couple hours away as of this recording. And also during this time, we saw the rise of, or the resurrection of the independent scene. Really, this rise started in the mid-2000s with small companies like Chikara and PGW, but it's really come into its own within the past 8 years. And you add in things like the use of YouTube from What Culture Pro Wrestling and other promotions like Red Pro Wrestling and Progress Wrestling, who would wrestle in smaller venues like bars and stuff like that. There is this very healthy independent wrestling scene where those who want to break into the wrestling business after they've learned their craft at wrestling schools can go to wrestle, along with veterans who don't have the ability to be at one of the big promotions anymore, but can, you know, again, still work their craft. And really, that's the scene of it today. You have the layers are, you have the bottom, you have the independent wrestling scene, where there's good sort of local wrestling. It's not as big as the territorial system is, but, you know, again, around the world, there are all these small little independent wrestling organizations. DDT Wrestling, Lucha Aero, just so many different little promotions that you can go see. Then there's sort of the mid-tier group, which would be Impact Wrestling, which is what TNA, formerly TNA, now Impact Wrestling. Trying to think, AAA promotion and CML really are in that area. And they're local to just being in Mexico. Pro Wrestling Noah, just to name a few. Then you have the top tier, that would be like New Japan and Ring of Honor and then at the top of the mountain really is WWE. It is the biggest promotion in the world. Though New Japan is really become the second. And it's competition, but it's also not competition. And really that's how it is. WWE has become to a size to where they're world renowned. And really I don't think anybody is really ever going to challenge them for that position. It's not just that, you know, Vince McMahon's there, but Vince McMahon also has people behind him after he's gone that will carry on the vision of what WWE needs to be. And it's going to be that way for a long time, unless something royally effed up happens. But there are a lot of promotions behind it that can do good business as being an alternative for those who maybe not like what WWE offers. So, and then with the internet and streaming services, they can get their product out to more people than ever before. You don't just have to have cable, you just need internet, and some still do the sort of pay for event services because they only do a couple events a year. But then you have things like New Japan and Ring of Honor that, you know, are combining for streaming services to where that you can watch their weekly stuff for a low, low price of usually just $10 a month. What am I missing? There is a new age that we get to see. The NWA has revived in a way with basically establishing a champion and going to different promotions and having NWA championship matches. And we've just, a couple days ago, had the announcement of All Elite Wrestling from the Young Bucks and Cody Rhodes of the Elite, a popular wrestling group that started in New Japan that's been able to branch out. And they're probably going to be doing the same thing, though they may also be doing the traditional route and trying to create a television product. We still don't know what's going to happen yet, but it's more than likely going to include internet and telling stories through YouTube series and stuff like that, very much like, in a way, what the NWA has been doing for the past year. And so the future looks bright for professional wrestling, and that is a really jumbled mess of a history, done very, very briefly, off the top of somebody's head, of professional wrestling. There's so much more detail within each era to go to, and that's why I highly suggest listening to the Cornette Drive Through and listening to Jim Cornette and his podcast. Listen to Bruce Pritchard's Something to Wrestle About podcasts. There are tons of wrestlers and former talent that have podcasts who do a lot of great history on wrestling, so I listen to that. And like I said, pretty much anybody you can find. WWE has a WWE Network, which is $10. I mean, with tons of content from old promotions like WCCW, World Class Championship Wrestling, Deep South Wrestling, Florida Championship Wrestling, the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, ECW, old WWF programming like Primetime Wrestling and Saturday Night's Main Event, all of their pay-per-views, all of WCW's Nitros and Thunders and their pay-per-views, all of ECW stuff, or almost all their stuff. I'm still waiting for Extreme Warfare Volume 2 to be put on the network so I can watch the night that Kimona Wanalea danced atop the ECW arena with her striptease. That's a whole different story. But New Japan, which again, as I said, in a couple hours, will have their WrestleMania, Wrestle Kingdom 13. They are going, they have the New Japan World, which it's not as good, it's far from being as good as the network. They need to work on it, but as it is right now, you can pay $10 a month and you can watch everything that they put out each month. They're generally weekly shows at Currican Hall and all of their pay-per-views and also the stuff that they do with Ring of Honor and other promotions. Ring of Honor has its own streaming service along with Impact Wrestling. Major League Wrestling, which is an up-and-coming promotion, which is mostly on the internet, has a weekly show on YouTube that you can find by going to Major League Wrestling. And pretty much any promotion out there has a website to where you can buy DVDs and watch their stuff. And like I said, the sort of the future is going to be these YouTube shows, though. Things like Being the Elite and 10 Pounds of Gold that are really going to change the way wrestling tells stories. So if there's just a wrestler you like, you can most likely follow them because they're most likely doing something on YouTube. People like Xavier Woods of The New Day in WWE has probably one of the most popular channels on YouTube with Up, Up, Down, Down. So if there's something you like, you can find it. And the thing I would say, for particular for anybody who's not a wrestling fan, but has interest in it and wants to see, maybe if they'd like it, again, I highly suggest the WWE Network only if the first month's free and you can just go around and see if there's anything that catches your mind. I need to probably do another episode where I need to give a list of matches that non-wrestling fans should watch that they would get. One I would put right out there would be Rey Mysterio versus Eddie Guerrero at Halloween Havoc 1997 or 1998. 1998 it would be. I would put John Cena versus Triple H at WrestleMania 22. John Cena versus Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 23. John Cena versus AJ Styles, Royal Rumble 2016. 16? No, no, no. 2017, excuse me. Yeah, it was 2017. I would put John Cena versus CM Punk on Raw in February 2014. Or February 2013, excuse me. Yeah, I put a lot of John Cena's because a lot of stuff of that stuff is good. Anything with the Cruiserweight division, WCW, especially the early Cruiserweight matches, amazing. NXT, though, I also think is a good way to get into wrestling. Again, WWE Network, it's their weekly show of their, what's their developmental division, but their developmental is filled with people just getting into the business along with established stars who are now transitioning to signing with the WWE, and they're transitioning into the WWE style. It's sort of a different way they do things. And so it's a good place because it's just wrestling done on a very traditional style. I maybe not with maneuvers done in the ring, but the way it's booked and stories are told. And it's a great way to see if you like professional wrestling. Not to mention the NXT TakeOver events are, bar none, the best events pretty much in all of wrestling. I mean, this past year, NXT events have been constantly doing a hold my beer, I'm going to top the one that came before mentality to it. So that is professional wrestling, sports entertainment, and what it is. And I hope you enjoyed this informative look, hopefully, into professional wrestling. And I hope you'll give my suggestions a try. And if you're somebody who doesn't usually watch wrestling, hopefully maybe this will, you'll give wrestling a try. You know, and if buying stuff on the internet doesn't catch your fancy, the fact is, Monday Night Raw and WWE SmackDown are still weekly television shows. You can catch Raw every Monday night on USA Network. And as of right now, SmackDown every Tuesday night on the USA Network. Though starting in the fall of October 2019. So if you're past this date, it's already happened. SmackDown will be on Fox. In what is one of the biggest deals ever in professional wrestling, as wrestling will once again, for the first time in ages, be on network television. So, thank you for this look. I hope you enjoyed it. And next episode, which will be coming out in a couple days, is the episode 100, where you'll be seeing my shining, smiling face. Because, like I said, in a couple hours, it is going to be Wrestle Kingdom 13. And that is what we're going to look at. As we'll look at whether Will Ospreay can defeat the new never openweight champion Kota Ibushi. Whether Kushida can defend his IWGP junior heavyweight title against Taiji Ishimori. We will see if Tetsuya Naito can strip the IWGP Intercontinental Championship away from Chris Jericho. Can Okada get his revenge against the traitor Jay White? And last but not least, we will see if tradition triumphs over Best Bout Machine as the Ace of Japan, Hiroshi Tanahashi, and this year's G1 Climax winner can win the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship from Kenny Omega. All that and more on the next episode. So until that time, my wrestling fans, I want you to remember that I am the most glorious Jew that ever lived, and your wrestling messiah. So just sit back, and bask in my glory.
You're all that I have and you're all that I need. Each and every day I pray to get to know you. Please wanna be close to you. Yes, I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you, there's no me or the air that I breathe. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With these demons around all around, I bring me down to negative vibe. But I believe, yes, I believe, I said I believe. I stand on two feet, one beat, right down on one knee. I fight with all of my might and get these demons to flee. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight unto the heights. Crown lights burning up, out of to the twilight. So thank you to my God, now I finally got it right. And I fight with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my mind. What's the feeling? My love will be for holding and sealing. I give myself to you from the essence of my being. And I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Time it starts a feeling. What's this feeling? My love will be for holding and sealing. I give myself to you from the essence of my being. And I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want